You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm very happy now to welcome William Powers. He's the author of the new book, Dispatches from the Sweet Life, One Family, 5 Acres, and a Community's Quest to Reinvent the World. He will be here in Santa Fe at Collected Works Bookstore on Wednesday, the 5th of September at 6:30 in the evening, and then the next day in Albuquerque at Bookworks at 7 in the evening. Welcome.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back on your show.
So this is the third book in a series of books that narrate the story of your own journey to explicitly, through your own life choices, address questions that so many of us are asking ourselves, like, how can we live more simply? How can we do less harm? How can we connect to nature and to ourselves and to community? What is enough? What of the Western mind is healthy and unhealthy? You and I talked 8 years ago when the first book in this series came out. It was called 12 by 12, which was about your living in a very small cabin. In this book, you describe the transition that you and your wife and baby daughter made by moving to Bolivia. Why Bolivia? Why did you move there as opposed to, say, a small town in the rural United States?
Well, my wife, who actually is originally from Santa Fe, and I met in New York City in 2009. And we both actually spent a total of, say, 6 years each in Bolivia in the 2000s. She was working with women's cooperatives and on the coca issue. And I was more involved with community-based development and conservation. So when we met in New York and lived there for several years, we always knew that we wanted to go back to Bolivia at some point because, you know, we both just kind of fell in love with the place and have such a connection to it from our previous years of working there.
So you and she moved there and your infant daughter and bought 5 acres of land, which you then built a house on, and you describe some of the ups and downs of the process of trying to grow plants, grow trees, build this house. And throughout the book, there are a lot of different metaphors that you weave throughout. And one of them is the dream, which is kind of the American dream, but more than that. Explain that idea.
Well, the dream is, I almost took it from Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, when he talks about, you know, the kind of dream of conquest and of domination. In Algonquin, they call it Wetiku, or this sort of cannibalizing spirit. So it's beyond the American dream of sort of laissez-faire capitalism and improving from generation to the next. And it's more of a dream of anthropocentric domination of nature. So, you know, we don't even see it, but embedded in kind of capitalism and, you know, our daily life and so forth is this underlying ethos where somehow humans are exceptional and outside of the web of life, and we can just kind of do whatever we want. So, you know, that was the way that I understood the dream, and it was a process of kind of creating a new one.
It's interesting because in this dream are a lot of things that people kind of assume are good, like progress and scientific method and ambition and development. And these are all things that you question.
Right. You know, there's a lot of debate about this now, even like Pinker's book about, you know, enlightenment now, and that, you know, science, reason, and progress are the way to go forward. And there's a lot of sort of pundits and writers taking that position. And then there's those of us, I think, in another camp that are saying, wait a minute, you know, this underlying sort of ideology of progress is, you know, having this idea that there's infinite resources available, but it's not true. We live on a finite planet, and we have to find ways to come into harmony with it. And so the book, as you know, is a real deep questioning of a lot of these underlying ideas, more than just kind of saying, well, we need to vote Democrats instead of Republicans, or we need to do recycling instead of not recycling, or something simple like that. It's a probe into like a lot of sort of what we take for granted. And I think that that's why, you know, doing it in this kind of a memoir form also for me is a way of kind of like storifying it and having like the reader step into these kind of complex and subtle and not often heard about issues in a way that's kind of, they can connect to you right away.
Right. when you try to let go of some of the ideas like ambition or self-improvement, that's one of the things that you write about. That's a kind of such a typically American thing. That brings up the question of what is the opposite of that? And again, in the American imagination, the opposite of self-improvement and ambition are things like laziness and resignation. But you're seeing something else.
Right. I think that, part of the Bolivian idea of living well, or, summa cum ana, vivir bien, has to do with not improving. It's sort of like the wu wei concept in Chinese of alert inactivity, where in a sense, just like everything else in nature is kind of doing as much as it needs to do to thrive and survive, but not always trying to do more and more and more. So too can humans come back into balance by not being lazy by any means, or not saying, let's not do anything, but it's just questioning the motto of never stop improving and just kind of stop improving a little bit. I mean, the impact that has is, for one thing, your personal happiness goes up, because I've heard one definition of happiness is like reality minus expectations is happiness, right? So if you just decrease your expectations of always competing and being better than the next person and shining and so forth, you do find more equilibrium and happiness. And the second thing is, for sure, there's less impact on our biophysical worlds, because the root cause of the environmental crisis has to do with human consumption. It's not the panthers or the Andean bears or the hummingbirds that are causing the crisis, it's ourselves. And more specifically, it's ourselves after the cognitive revolution, 70,000 years ago, where we started imagining bigger meta stories and creating these big systems of culture beyond the smaller groups of Homo sapiens that used to exist. So we create these big stories and ideologies, and the primary one now is progress. So I think, in some ways, by questioning it, it's very controversial in a sense, but it makes a lot of sense.
What did that look like for you? What does that look like for you living in Bolivia, but also still coming back to the US, writing books, telecommuting, teaching, and things that are, still keep you very connected to this world?
Right, it's a constant struggle, because it's part of our kind of cultural DNA, including my own, that ambition. So I'm not saying that I've perfected the art of disconnecting and detethering from ambition and progress and so forth. I mean, I'm very much a part of it. But I think that the whole idea of being in transition is not that you're perfect, but it's that you see that other vision of like where we could be as a culture and where I could be as a person, and you take steps in that direction. So like, whereas maybe before I was constantly on my gadgets and more of a workaholic and so forth, this experience of kind of decolonizing some of my deeper beliefs, has led me, I think, to be calmer and to do what needs to be done, but then no more. And part of this is like detaching from the results of my actions. So I'll just do something, like if I'm writing a book, I'm doing it because I love doing it. And I feel like it's a gift to others, and I just feel passionate about it. So you just do it, but then you kind of forget about it. You know what I mean? And you're not constantly worrying about, oh, am I reaching enough readers? Am I? And I'll just give you another example. Melissa and I, my wife, we were thinking about founding a big sort of NGO and so forth in Bolivia, because we do have a lot of skills and contacts and ability to make social change and so forth. So we went through a couple of years of really questioning whether that's what we should be doing. And we kind of came down the side of, no, let's not do this big thing. We'll do a smaller thing that'll have impact, but that also lets us have balance. So I think that's the kind of thinking that we've been going through.
And there's this wonderful moment in the book where your wife says to you, "Did you hear that?" And you said, "Hear what?" And she said, "That was the sound of the last bit of our ambition draining away."
Right, that was a funny comment that you had.
It was great, and it was very interesting because it certainly, I think, makes me question myself, makes I think probably many of your readers question themselves. And this is a question that I've been going through all my life because I think the question of ambition versus lack thereof has always been a kind of dialectic that I've worked with and struggled with because too much of either one doesn't seem to work very well. But this idea that you're bringing up, and it's another term that you bring up throughout the book, is this idea of transition. What does that mean? Like, who's transitioning from what to what? in your world over in Bolivia, who's using and embracing that concept?
Well, there's of course the global transition town movement or the transition initiatives, which also includes transition streets.
Tell us what that is.
There's the global transition movement with 1,600 communities in 45 countries, of which we're a part in our town in Bolivia, and which hundreds of American towns and transition streets are involved. And that idea is moving from high carbon, global trading type of anonymous communities to more community, more connection with neighbors, local economies, and then clean energy and organic agriculture. But it's a way that kind of local economies like Santa Fe, Boulder, places around the country are kind of moving in that direction through this rubric and through this way of being connected with other localizing communities. So that's the one level. But I also kind of use the term transitioning to talk about like our own personal selves. That it's not that we're one thing or the next. We're transitioning from being overly ambitious, overly consumptive, individualistic, and deconnected with others of our own species and the rest of nature, to another vision, which may even be multi-generational, but where if you plant the seeds now with the way you're raising our children, the way we're creating community, I can envision something in the future where, we have these small localized economies connected through an intelligent federalism to the national or to larger units, but the local community is the primary. And then you have more free time, more of a biocentric point of view, where we're part of the web of life instead of atop the pyramid of resources, and where there's just more personal happiness and satisfaction when I think people become more like creatures among creatures instead of separated. So this is the story of separation that we're in, this idea that somehow we're not part of the biosphere. So I guess that's maybe my central kind of philosophical idea is that, we have to get into this biocentric or ecocentric point of view.
And it's interesting because, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, in Bolivia, what you encountered there was an informal economy. So, where you could hire people to make adobe bricks, and basically everybody living in the town and the sort of surrounding area of the town where you live is an entrepreneur who are all doing kind of small scale things. And from an international economic development perspective, as you write, that's called failure. So what you're trying to, like what your vision is for transition is exactly the opposite of what the development community is striving for.
And I wouldn't say that either that we can't also globalize some things and that there can't be this. There's going to be a larger global economy 50 years from now, 100 years from now. There has been for hundreds of years. Because what I'm saying is that right now, something like 95% of GDP goes through big corporations, right? So then, of course, those corporations have 95% of the influence on the political structures. In some ways, we act surprised when there's corporate interest in Washington or lobbying and stuff, but really, that's what the definition you might say of the government is, in some sense, is it's representing the key economic interests of the country, right? This is not just true in the U.S., it's true in Asia, it's true in Europe and around the world. So this transition process, if you localize more instead of just globalizing, you bring more resources to the communities, you have stronger businesses at the local level. It not only unleashes freedom and independence, I call it like an enlightened anarchy, where you have, for example, in our town in Bolivia, you have all these entrepreneurs. There are no jobs, external jobs. But, that's a de facto situation where they just failed to enter the global economy because they didn't follow the prescriptions of the IMF and the World Bank and so forth, right? But the interesting thing is that, like, here in the West, transition towns like Totnes in England, Byron Bay in Australia, even bigger cities like Freiburg in Germany, they're pulling more of that power to the local level, right? And so they're kind of creating a situation like you have in the global South, like in our town in Bolivia, through policies. For example, in Totnes, they pulled, I think, 2 million British pounds out of the like supermarket chains and brought them to local stores through a conscious effort. And they created their own beer factory recently to not only have fun making beer together and drinking it together, but also bring all those jobs to the local level. So to me, it's really exciting. I think it's can be kind of fun, this whole idea of localizing and taking back that power.
Yeah, I mean, I think the subversive part of it is if we all lived in a much more local way. You know, the food that we ate was primarily locally grown. If we got our exercise through working and walking and dancing instead of going to the gym, let's say, if we prevented illnesses by eating well and used primarily herbal medicine, if we used renewable energy, if we caught rainwater, I mean, all of these things that you're doing and thinking about and talking about, that would take huge sectors out of the world economy. I mean, one could argue that you take enough sectors out of that in the world, that globalized economy would fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Or it would be a gradual process of transitioning from a hyper control of the global economy by these huge, massive corporate interests to slowly rationing it up from, like, say, 5% of GDP going through the local tap, it'd be 25, 30%. And then the political power goes up proportionally to that economic power. And then you have the localized governments and institutions linked up and able to influence central governments. So that's why it's a long-term process, but I think we have to start it.
Now, Bolivia has a kind of remarkably earth-friendly constitution. What does it say? How does it work? Is this part of that transition concept?
Definitely. The Bolivian constitution gives rights to Mother Earth. It's one of the first constitutions in the world, along with Ecuador, to bring about this idea of earth rights that's now catching on in the West as well. There's the Law of Mother Earth, which is a framework law that gives 9 rights to the earth itself, including the right not to have mega projects affect its vital ecosystem services, and the right not to have the genetic code modified, things like that. Now, this is a landmark law. It's not being implemented perfectly by any means, because Bolivia is affected by giant countries like Brazil, Argentina, Chile around it, and also by China, Russia, and the U.S. right now, because it's got so much natural resources like tin, natural gas, and so forth. So there's competition to get those resources and corruption of the political process in Bolivia, right? So it's not like it's a perfect thing, but it comes out of this beautiful philosophical tradition of living well, the idea of human well-being is tied not just to rich human community, but to connection with nature. So that's the fundamental idea. So of course, it's part of transition. You know, living well and this law of Mother Earth are part of a global reaction against neoliberal capitalism that's throughout the global South. So others have to do with the commons, the idea of what are the global commons for people, not just for companies. Localization movements like transition is part of it. And some of these philosophies. So I really feel like it's a wonderful moment in some ways. How are we rethinking all of this stuff? And how can we learn from these more indigenous ideas about creating new futures that also encompass ancestral values?
And yet it's a continual battle. I mean, there's this moment where Coca-Cola briefly invades your town and brings a huge kind of inflatable red thing and hands out Coca-Cola to all the kids, and they get completely amped up on sugar and caffeine for a while. And that's relatively benign compared to some of the other things that are happening in terms of, I mean, you describe it, I'm not sure if this was in Bolivia, but of a woman whom you met who was indigenous, and the petroleum people were coming to her village and trying to buy them out or promise them improvement, but then when they said no, threatening them and saying, we're going to do this no matter what. And it's those incredibly painful, horrifying examples of raw power of these industries to ruin exactly the kind of life that you're talking about really being a teacher for the rest of us.
Right. The obstacles are enormous. If you really, the first mall in Bolivia that I talk about in the book that opens 2 years ago,
yeah,
bringing, you know, 200 chains from Asia, the United States, and so forth, and then the extreme marketing power behind that, whereas local foods like salteñas, cuñapé, and so forth are being replaced by Big Macs and other foods because, you know, those local businesses really can't compete on Facebook and social media and on television and so forth. So what do you do about that? I mean, you know, in some ways, I think that Paul Hawkins' idea of 2 million antibodies to what you could call ecocide or the destruction of life's living system by this economic model is part of it. So all these women's cooperatives, transition towns, local groups in the big city near us in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, you know, there's the bicycling group, which is pushing for bike lanes. There's the tree planting organization that's legally fighting any trees that are being cut down. There's Revolución Higote, which is looking at how to recapture local culture. So you have these civil society and human reactions to this growth model, which that's the antibody.
Yeah.
And I think the other part of the antibody is spiritual change and meditation, yoga, time in the wilderness. You know, it's like Thoreau said, if you're visiting the town for gossip about what's going on in the world, you haven't visited yourself in a while. I think we could say the same thing about, you know, if you're looking to CNN for news, are you really looking into yourself for news about what's going on? So just reconnecting to ourselves and our deeper nature, because I find, at least, and maybe some of you have also found, and I don't know if you found, but the deeper you go into meditation or into just solitude, the more that you just connect to like the fact that we are part of nature and we're a creature and we're happy naturally without all of this stuff. So it's a subtle thing. But when I look at, you know, the way that corporations are mining resources around the global south in Bolivia, the destruction of these rivers and so forth by mining practices and natural gas extraction, there's a similar mining going on of our solitude by corporations. The fact that, like, you know, the average American checks their cell phone when they first wake up and right before they go to bed and during the dinner conversation and so forth. We don't have solitude, and all of those electronic spaces are commercialized.
Right.
So how do we overcome some of that?
And those things seem like they should be simpler choices than they are, because part of what goes on with that is kind of colonizing our minds so that we feel, I don't know, addicted or habituated or whatever, dopamine induced to do these things. You know, it seems like a habit that we should be able to break more easily than we do.
Right. I think a lot of people are breaking it. I've just seen, even traveling around the country now, around Dispatches from the Sweet Life, this book, and just meeting all these people that are questioning it deeply. You know, I was just in Chapel Hill last week, and we had a huge crowd come out, and from all walks of life that are questioning it. And that's where we have to go, is just each person and each family, and then also in tribe and whatever your community is, however you define it, questioning that growth model and looking for alternatives that are just more life enriching.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about this book is the ongoing narrative about your daughter, who is an infant when she's just born when the book begins, and she's a toddler by the time it ends, and now she's probably, what, 6 years old, something like that?
Yeah, she's 5 years old.
5 years old. And one of the things that I thought was interesting and striking and just really subtle was, instead of saying to her when you were showing her what things were, instead of saying, this is a tree, saying, we call this a tree. What's the difference between those two things?
Mm-hmm. Well, to say this is a tree is saying that this external object that I'm going to put this human grunt on, this combination of vowels and consonants, it's very reductive to reducing a connected part of yourself. The tree is a connected part of you. That's La Pacha in Living Well cosmology in Bolivia. It means the unified field, right? So the tree is part of you, as is the sky, as is the air, everything like that. So this anthropocentric tendency to label things reduces it. You know, it's like, as soon as you label a bird flying by, you'll never see that bird again. So with sort of biocentric parenting, or I call it childing, you know, it's kind of stepping into the child's world and realizing that. I mean, I know my daughter, who's 5, does not see a difference between herself. I mean, obviously there's an ego, right? But there's a deeply biocentric feeling that she has with nature, with the ants that she's feeding and with climbing the trees and the sky and so forth. So by saying we call this a tree, it's just recognizing the fact that we are reducing it for our own needs to this label, but that's not what it is.
I can't help but wondering also, like, I feel like I want you to write another sequel 25 years from now, because how does this girl, this beautiful child whom I can, you don't have pictures in the book, but one can almost see her, the way she's running around and being sort of a little redhead and getting to know people and nature and all these different elements in such a open and such a questioning way. And at the same time, as you say, she perceives, and perceived very quickly, that your livelihood came not from the ground or the trees or anything else, but from your cell phones and laptops and your Wi-Fi. And she's spent time, of course, in New York and places like that too. So she's getting really, again, those two worlds. And it's too early to say right now, but do you have a sense how she's integrating those things?
Well, you know, I sometimes call it more like the bohemian perspective, for want of a better word, as opposed to more of like a bourgeois perspective. I just reduce it to categories. But the bohemian perspective in some ways is not saying you have to be perfect or you're hypocritical if you don't have these tensions and contradictions. I mean, Walt Whitman, our great poet, said, "Do I contain contradictions? Yes, I do. You know, I am large. I contain multitudes."
Yeah.
So there's this way of being human that's non-judgmental of yourself as you're in transition towards something else. And so I think what she's getting is this sense that it's not either or. And that is a key concept of living well, the sweet life in Bolivia, la vida dulce, is that there is no either or. There's both and. Like, this dialectic is a Western need to say this is right and that's wrong. So I think what she's getting is the sense that it's a huge world full of just absolute beauty. And in a sense, you know, at the same time that we're earning our living, not strictly from the land and so forth, most of it is being earned by writing, by teaching, consulting, and so forth. At the same time, she also sees that we're harvesting so much of what we eat from our gardens and orchard, that we're walking everywhere, that we're connecting to community in a real way, and that we're appreciating this connection to Pachamama, or Mother Earth, not just as a kind of, oh yeah, you know, let's go for a hike on the weekends, but every single moment we're acknowledging and giving thanks for this creation that we're part of.
Right, right. And there's complexities to that that are just paradoxes that, as you say, you kind of have to live with. Like, there's this moment where you're bringing in money from outside, you're hiring people to work for you, you're giving some local people work. That gives them, and they thank you for, the freedom that they have to then stay in town and not move to the big city and be part of the system that you're escaping from, but still dependent on. So it's like, you can't really assign right or wrong to it. It's just like living with those paradoxes.
Right. You know, there's a sociologist named Javier Medina in Bolivia who talks about, like, el tercer incluido. It's like the third included. And I've seen this among indigenous people in Bolivia. If you ask a question, it's like, they're not really going to say yes or no, because it's both at the same time. It's the third, which is yes, no. It's very hard to explain to our analytical minds that are so in need of these moral distinctions being so clear and so forth. It's just that it is. It basically, you might say that the best way to understand it is it's the present moment awareness of Buddhism, that what is the reality. And then you move forward with that. And I find it a better way to live. Personally, it just feels more unique when I go, like, you know, Bolivia has a ministry of decolonization, like in their government, they're trying to decolonize their institutions. Like, so in our family, we have kind of our little mini ministry of decolonization, you know, and we decolonize some of these ideas of like what we should be doing and right and wrong. And I know there are judgments, of course, still, but it just, I don't know, it opens up this whole new space.
Now, there's also the question of how you are relating to the people in the town where you live. And that's also some of the questions that you are deeply raising in this book. In other words, do they see you as privileged foreigners? Do they see you as true friends? There's a moment where one of them comes and asks to buy just a little piece of your land, and she doesn't have land and you do, and she's local and you're not. And these things are really complicated, and you even question whether the whole concept of transition is an idea that you are imposing in a colonialist manner more than you had thought. Talk about that.
Right. Those are things that we struggled with from the beginning. Even when we bought our land there, we were kind of asking, are we gentrifying this to Western tastes and raising the cost of land by buying something here?
Yeah.
You know, or if you bring in something like transition, which actually started in England in the mid-2000s, is that another form of colonization of something from the outside? You know, these are questions that we're always walking, those questions. You know, the overall gist of things is that we feel very integrated, and that, you know, our town has some people from 30 countries in this 5,000-person town. And despite the fact that there's been ups and downs and it's gone through changes, there overall is a positive relationship between people who've come in from other places and the locals. It's a cosmopolitan village, basically, because it's not just foreigners that have come in that make up like 3 or 4% of the population. You know, there's a huge percentage from other parts of Bolivia that have come to this town. So, yeah, those are just excellent questions. And, you know, as I write about, there was moments of real discrimination against us as foreigners. At one point, we were rounded up in the restaurants and taken in for fingerprinting in the police station and actually were detained while they checked our papers and fingerprinted us and so forth. It really made me realize, you know, the kind of situation that people must feel here. I mean, obviously not to the same extent because we are relatively privileged, but they deported some people, some Germans, and they can do that. You're not really at home unless you have the citizenship.
Right.
So it's almost like stepping into like some of the discriminatory immigration practices here in the U.S. It was like feeling a little bit of what that tastes like on the other side.
Interesting. You are living what some might call the best of both worlds. You're restoring land, you're living in community in a beautiful place, you are really deeply reconnecting in nature in the way that many of us would hope to, but haven't done. At the same time, you have a washing machine, you have Wi-Fi, you're teaching online, you're doing airplane travel. And I know this is just a thought experiment, and I know that everything you're saying is the opposite of this kind of question that I'm about to ask you, but if you had to give up one of those worlds, do you know which it would be?
Right, that's an excellent question. I mean, I would give up, if I had to give up one of them, I would prefer the simpler life, closer to nature, in community, what we have in Bolivia. However, that's not the only world. You know, it's one integrated whole with this globalization and so forth. And so, you know, we know people, for example, I mentioned in the book, there's a woman in our town who's from Connecticut, from a upper class family in Connecticut, and she hasn't been back to the U.S. in 20 years, you know.
Yeah.
She married a Chilean jeweler, and they have their life, and they're very happy, and it's just a complete disconnection. And they kind of live like in the national forest buffer zone there, like living off the land, making jewelry. It's just, you know, that's one possibility. But I think what we've kind of decided that feels more authentic to us is engaging. So it's like, that's what transition in some ways is for me, like teaching the university students that come through, the American university students and Chinese and so forth. And I'm teaching and doing the writing and so forth. It's a dynamic way of, I don't know, connecting those two worlds.
What are your hopes for writing these books? I mean, they make me think and perhaps change or open up how I think, but I'm not changing how I live, at least not that much. And I'm aware of that. I'm like super conscious of how I live and of the consumerism and the online business and all of that stuff. But it's devilishly hard to change when you don't kind of make a radical change. But that's about me. What about you? What are your hopes for this book and this series of books?
You know, it's called the kind of Beyond the American Dream trilogy, where there was sort of 12 by 12, which was about a guy living in an off-grid shack. And then, you know, New Slow City is about a couple, my wife and I, living in a New York City micro apartment, trying to simplify life in New York. And then Dispatches from the Sweet Life is the third, which is kind of a family in a Bolivian transition town. And I think the hope for this is that people will walk questioning and just kind of begin to shift their paradigm. I don't think that it causes an immediate, it's not a how-to guide. As you know from having read it, it's a complex kind of self-questioning and, you know, working through all these things in a way that, like, hopefully, my biggest hope is that the reader, like, reads this and just really enjoys it, like they would enjoy a novel. And that process has a subtle change in their software, let's just say, you know, it just kind of sinks in. It becomes part of a bigger cultural change. So it's like a gift to like these different movements that come from different directions. So like Bill McKibben's writing directly about like sort of carbon and fossil fuels and so forth. And you have Paul Hawkins' new book and, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates and other people coming out from different directions. But I just like to be part of that cultural milieu where we're questioning very deeply the system.
And that's one of the concepts in the book, is this phrase, caminar preguntando, walk questioning.
Right, exactly. I love that phrase. And that's what I tell my students a lot, too, is just, you know, each step you take, another question. And you move forward with that open attitude. And even, you know, thinking about your question, you're right. You know, like, there are a lot of things that are contradictory, even what we're doing and what all of us are doing. everything is kind of tainted in a sense, but that's okay. I think as long as you have this kind of like norte or this north focus, which is toward something that's more sustainable and centered with nature and more earth-based, you know, and that we step into our right place in creation instead of being on top of it, if we have kind of that view for the long term, the kind of compromises we're making today don't necessarily mean as much. I mean, like, what's the substitute for air travel right now? You know, if you want to be connected in that sense, you kind of have to take airplanes that are burning fossil fuels. I mean, you can substitute organic tomatoes for non-organic or something like that, but you can't substitute air travel at this point. So I guess I just take each trip I take, I'm just saying, okay, well, is it really worth the carbon being burnt here for the message that I'm bringing, like, or what I'm doing?
Right. William Powers is author of the new book, Dispatches from the Sweet Life, One Family, 5 Acres, and a Community's Quest to Reinvent the World. Once again, he will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Wednesday, September 5th at 6:30 in the evening, and at the next day, Albuquerque, Thursday at 7 in the evening at Bookworks. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.